Gentlemen, first case for argument, United States v. Black. Mr. Fry.
Good morning, Your Honors. I want to say a few words at the beginning about the obstruction conviction, and then I plan to talk about the APC charges. I don't need to dwell on the obstruction case because I think it's pretty well covered in the briefs. I have to say that I think this is the weakest case I've seen in 45 years of law practice. The judge and jury below seem to have lost sight of the fact that in order to convict Mr. Black of obstruction, it was necessary to find an intent to remove, conceal or destroy documents. Moving documents from one location to another does not conceal or destroy them, does not prevent compliance with investigative requests. In this case, the conviction was obtained notwithstanding the long history of full cooperation and extensive combing of the documents in Mr. Black's files and at Inc. And the production by Mr. Black of 112,000 pages.
Had the documents in that office been examined before?
Yes, they've been thoroughly gone through by Sullivan and Cromwell lawyers. There were five prior SEC
in that
document
particular
production.
Office with those files there.
The files were mostly kept in his secretary's office, but they were given full access, and there's testimony of this in the record, not only in the offices at 10 Toronto, but in his other offices and in his homes. And they went through documents in all those places.
The government? You mentioned Sullivan and Cromwell.
Yes. Excuse me?
Went through the documents?
Sullivan and Cromwell was retained to assist in the compliance with the...
Was retained by the government?
No,
by the criminal investigation?
No, by Mr. Black. There was...
Did the Justice Department go through the documents?
No, the Justice Department did not go through the documents. However, the question is whether you could conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that when Mr. Black moved the documents from 10 Toronto to his residence in Toronto, he did so for the purpose of concealing or destroying documents. And our position is that you cannot reasonably conclude that. It seems to me the standard the government is asking for is the it's not inconceivable that he's guilty standard, which of course is not the standard. Well, let me turn to the APC counts, and I speak here on behalf of all the defendants. I thought I'd start off by making clear the interrelationship between the money property theory and the honest services theory.
I don't understand that.
You don't understand the relationship?
Yeah.
Well, that's why I thought I'd start with that. I didn't know whether you understood it or
not. What I mean is the $5.5 million, the $600,000?
Talking about the $5.5 million.
That's very straightforward, right? I mean, the government's position is they defrauded the corporation by diverting this money for themselves, pretending it was compensation for. I mean, pretending it was previously authorized management fees that were being described as non-competition compensation in order to beat Canadian taxes. Okay, so whether that's right or wrong, it seems to me quite separate from any, honest services contentions.
Well, I agree with that, but the government's position primarily is that the honest services violation was the theft of money from the employer.
Was what? I'm sorry?
Theft of money from the employer, the misappropriation of International's money. That they say that's not.
I don't understand. If there's, misappropriation of the money, you don't reach the honest services issue, right?
That's what the Orsburn case.
So what's your argument? That they confused the jury or what?
Yes. Well, our argument is twofold. First, assuming there's insufficient evidence, as we contend, of a money property theft, of a misappropriation.
Well, wait, but that's the big issue, right? That's the big issue.
I'm just talking about the interrelationship with honest services.
Well, if you can't beat that issue, I don't know what you get out of honest services.
Well, we still get something significant out of honest services because the problem, if there is insufficient evidence of a money or property theft, then the government can't be saved by honest services. That's Orsburn and Thompson. If there's sufficient evidence of an honest services of a money or property, it does not follow that you can uphold the conviction.
Well, that I don't.
Let me try to explain.
You have a general verdict.
You
have a general verdict, right?
We have a general verdict, but under Yates, there were two alternative theories put to the jury. The first theory was the money or property theory. The second theory was the honest services theory. The jury was allowed to convict on the honest services theory without ever finding that there was a misappropriation.
General verdict, right? Look, there's a lot of evidence of an ordinary theft, and, you know, it's so presumably that's what they focused on, right? No reason to think they found no theft and then got...
Well, the government included this charge over the defendant's objections.
Yes, of course. That's always the case, right? And you were acquitted on a number of counts.
There were two theories of possible guilt submitted to the jury. One theory was that money or property was misappropriated. One theory was that the company was deprived of the honest services of its employees. On the latter theory, which was an alternative basis for conviction, the jury was not required to find any theft of money or property.
Of course.
Well, so for all we know, the conviction in this case...
Of course, that's what you have with a general verdict, right? You don't know exactly what the jury's thinking was.
But the law
now
is...
Now you say, well, you should have asked them, you know, submitted interrogatories after the fact.
Well...
Could have asked for, you know, special verdict or what have you.
I think Sorich was a general verdict, and yet the court was quite clear in Sorich that under the Yates principle, if there was a legal defect in the submission of the honest services theory, the defendants are entitled to a new trial. I think that's the law under the Yates principle. That is, I think the principle is if you submit the case to the jury under one legally valid and one legally invalid theory, the jury returns a general verdict. The defendants are entitled to a new trial if the verdict could have rested on the legally invalid theory. We have no assurance that this verdict rested on a legally valid theory.
Because, you know, often there are errors in instructions, you know, we say harmless, right? You're not dissolving the harmless error rule, are you?
No, if this error were harmless, of course the government could.
But look, the bulk of the evidence has to do with rather, you know, pretty naked fraud, right? So.
No, I would not say the
bulk
of the evidence.
I know you wouldn't, of course, but you know that's the theory which anybody can grasp most easily. So if there's abundant evidence of that, as Judge St. Eve said. In her post-trial ruling, then why would we have to worry about the honest services, which is, you know, admittedly a confused area of law? And
because you have no assurance that the jury actually found the thing.
We never have assurance when you apply the harmless error doctrine, right? Never have assurance.
Well, harmless error would be a different point. That is, if you want to say...
I understand why it would be a different point.
It's a different point from the Yates point. You might say there's no chance that the jury rested on honest services. That would be a harmless error finding.
Exactly.
I think that would be completely wrong on the facts of this case.
Why?
Because the government placed great emphasis on various things that it contended were a breach of the duty of honest services. The failure to submit these related party transactions to the audit committee, which, by the way, none of the defendants would have known about. The misstatements made in the proxy statement and the shareholder statements after the completion of the offense. All of these things provided the jury with a basis for saying, we're not convinced that this was a misappropriation or a scheme to misappropriate money. It may have just been a recharacterization. But we do find that the defendants made a gain, the Canadian tax benefit, and that they engaged in a breach of fiduciary duty. And under the instructions, which we say were legally erroneous, that was all that they had to find. Now, I see my time is running out.
So far as supposing they, you know, didn't disclose this to the audit committee and the board and so on, then what, in your view, would the government have to show a, deprivation of honest services?
The government would have to show... in this category of case, the government would have to show money or property. That is, Orsburn and Thompson seem quite clear in holding that the case where you receive money from a third party, a bribe or a kickback, is the kind of case where honest services applies. If you have what are called the self-dealing category of cases, there has to be some pecuniary injury. The jury was not required to find any harm to International, and there may have been no harm to International if the money was management fees recharacterized. So the jury was able to convict in this case without ever having to decide whether there was a misappropriation of money.
What's your view of the following hypothetical case? Really simple, because, you know, this honest services confusing area. So suppose you were owed $100 by your law firm, and you were having a lot of trouble, you know, getting the money from them, and they were haggling over you and so on. So you just went to the petty cash, helped yourself to $100, you know, pocketed it. And actually, you know, you were owed it, and they were, you know, they were horsing you around. Would that be a breach of fiduciary duty to your firm?
Well, it might or might not be a breach of fiduciary duty.
Well,
I don't think
understand.
It would be a
yes
Section
no.
1340.
Yes or no?
I'm not sure. We debated the question, and there was an internal disagreement among us as to whether the failure to...
Who are you talking about?
I think it's a difficult question whether that would be a breach of fiduciary duty. What I think is clear is that a breach of fiduciary duty is not enough. The court says 1346 in the context of private employer cases is limited to bribes and kickbacks. Thompson said that about as clearly as it could have been said. And Orsburn says essentially the same thing. And Sorich says that the private gain has to be an illegitimate gain. And in the evidence in this case, there was nothing illegitimate about the Canadian tax gain. So there's a triple whammy.
So in my hypothetical case, you'd say that is not an honest services fraud.
It may be a breach of fiduciary duty, but it's not an honest services fraud that's actionable under the statute.
So are we hearing from the other defendant's lawyers first? Or?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. So thank you, Mr. Fry. Mr. Schachter?
Good morning. I would like to address two issues this morning. First, that it was error for the court not to give the limiting instruction that the defense requested. The government examined 14 witnesses at trial regarding inaccuracies in Hollinger's disclosure of the non-compete payments. The government then invited the jury to convict based on this uncharged conduct. The government said this to the jury, these words, I quote, "The crime here is the defendant's lies to the shareholders about why over $60 million went to Inc. and to the top four executives." But that was not the crime that was charged. The charge scheme...
What was the limiting instruction you wanted?
The instruction that we requested was to inform the jury
What is the text of it?
We requested it both orally and in writing.
Yeah, well, what is the text of the instruction you requested?
The text of the instruction that we requested in writing was that the jury could not convict based on... I can't recall the exact words, but based on the SEC disclosures. In orally, we argued to the court very clearly that we were not arguing that the jury could not consider the evidence.
It was the judge an instruction that you wanted her to give the jury.
Yes.
Where is that, or what is that? What does it say?
The instruction is found it's in our supplemental appendix. At essay 155. It stated that you have heard evidence in the case regarding the disclosures of non-competition payments in Hollinger International's quarterly and annual reports and proxy statements in 2001 and 2002. The defendants are not charged with making false or misleading statements in these filings, and you may not conclude that a defendant is guilty of mail or wire fraud based on any alleged false statements or omissions in any of these filings.
Doesn't that overstate the law? Because, of course, the jury could convict based, at least in part, on the post-cover-up conduct, or well, the post-fraud cover-up conduct.
The instruction, that the written instruction provided would have been better had it said based solely on these disclosures.
So
there's
the
no dispute about
the
that.
The instruction that you asked for did overstate the law.
The
and
written
so
instruction.
The district court was within its discretion to decline to give it.
Well, I'll say that it's certainly that is the instruction that we intended was based solely. It would have been better had the written instruction said based solely. However, the court was not confused as to what we requested. There was lengthy oral argument on this point.
What is confusion? She didn't think you meant solely, surely. If you meant solely, you'd say solely.
Well, our request orally, I think, made it very clear that our position was based solely. We said in no uncertain terms to the court, and there was no dispute in the courtroom.
Look, you have to give a correct instruction to the judge. You can't sandbag the judge by giving an overbroad instruction and then complaining on appeal that, well, she should have edited for you.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that limiting instructions can be requested both in writing and orally. And we made the request orally, and it was very clear to the court that it was our position.
Transcript of that.
If I may have a moment.
You made a request orally to supplement that or to change that written instruction?
We argued orally, I believe, both before and after we submitted the written instruction on this point, in which we asked orally for a... for the limiting instruction. And the language of that is very clear. It's at page 23 of our reply. I'm sorry, it's page 87 of our opening brief. It's essay 271 through 76. Was a lengthy discussion on what exactly the instruction was that we were requesting. And we said clearly, this is a quote, "Now I'm not saying it's not relevant evidence, but what I'm saying is that this jury runs a risk of being confused. And they should be, we think they should be told, look, the charged criminal conduct here are not the disclosures." And we proposed a series of limiting instructions. This is not an issue that came up just once during the course of the trial.
Yes, of course. And this is the same instruction that it's essay 156. All you're doing is defending the instruction. You were not offering a different instruction with the solely in there.
I think that...
I'm looking at your own brief, you know. The defendants proposed a series of limiting instructions culminating with the request for the... That's the culmination, your essay 156. That's your culmination. There's no solely there.
Well, Your Honor... respectfully, we think that we made an oral request that said we're not saying the jury can't consider the evidence.
You made an oral request for the written instruction that you submitted.
The judge did instruct the jury that this isn't a securities fraud case. The charged conduct is not the securities fraud or the misstatements in the post-fraud disclosures.
And it's our position, Your Honor, that that is not an instruction that's intelligible for the jury. The question wasn't whether or not the defendants are charged with securities fraud. The question is whether or not they can convict based on mail or wire fraud based on a finding that these are false statements in the SEC filings.
And
that wasn't the crime that was charged.
I assume those arguments were amply made during closing argument.
The argument that was made by the government was incorrect. The
Did
government
you object?
We did object.
Contemporaneously?
We did object at multiple times during the summation to that point that they were not charged with that the crime wasn't the false statements. Those objections were overruled.
During the summation, during the closing arguments?
Yes.
Huh.
Yes. And the prosecution's statement to the jury that this was the crime that was charged was an invitation to convict based on uncharged conduct. The scheme ended in May of 2001. These disclosures were not issued until nearly a year after the fact. And these disclosures weren't even mentioned in the information. given the vagueness of the jury's instructions that they received on what an honest, what constitutes a deprivation of honest services, we felt that there was a real danger that the jury would find that these after-the-fact disclosures were the breach of fiduciary duty and convict on an improper basis. We were very concerned. We raised the issue multiple times to the district court.
But you presumably also told the jury that this was not a securities fraud case and they couldn't convict on the basis just of a fraudulent statement to the SEC. I mean, you did say that in your closing argument, presumably.
We made arguments to the jury, and the arguments are neither instructions.
You answered my question. Did you make that point in your closing argument? You or the other lawyers?
We certainly made arguments that that there was no that they did not evidence an intent to defraud. I don't know that we specifically identified for the jury what exactly the charges were. We focused our efforts on establishing that these this was not evidence of a fraudulent intent.
Judge Eve, St. Eve, will tell you this is not a securities fraud case, not being charged with making false statements in a prospectus or what have you, in 10K, right? You say that, right?
I cannot recall now whether or not that is a specific statement that was made to the jury, but that was our
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schachter. Mr. Greenberg?
Good morning, Your Honors. You have all sat and decided recently Oster's instruction, conscious avoidance cases. You, Judge Kinney, have been particularly active, I note, in a number of cases. And you, Judge Posner, were the author of Giovanetti, the one and only reversal in the history of this circuit on Oster's instruction. I'd like to believe that this case demonstrates we need another reversal, because this case is unlike any of the ones that you judges have decided. This is nowhere remotely like the honest services cases, the Oster's instruction cases that you have upheld. Now, I'm not going to repeat to you the law of Oster's instruction, conscious avoidance. You know it as well or better than I do. But the government's principal arguments for the conscious avoidance argument, instruction, were all impermissible. And we're all beside the point. For example, the government argued to the district court, well, they made these false statements afterwards, after they got these payments, as much as a year afterwards. Well, you know, Judge Posner, in Giovanetti, you said, what a defendant later learns to be the case is not the test for whether, at the time of the misconduct, he consciously avoided learning the awful truth that a crime was afoot. And in that case, it was renting a house to some gamblers as a wire room. And so you ruled on that very directly, that statements or knowledge learned much later were not relevant. They argued, well, there should have been inquiry. First of all, nothing here was so suspicious that demanded inquiry. But if inquiry was required, there was plenty of inquiry made. Your Honors are aware that when KPMG, the outside auditor, went to the audit committee,
Wait. So specifically, I'm looking at Judge St. Eve's discussion of deliberate ignorance on pages, you know, SA 214 and 214 to 217. So is there something there that you think is erroneous on her part?
Well, obviously she is. We don't question the boilerplate.
No, I understand. That's cases. Why I'm not yes. talking about that. I'm looking at the pages on which she says there was deliberate ignorance.
Yes, of course we do challenge it. For example, at some point along the way, she mentions that there was, at least for defendant Bulpe, there were conversations with a lawyer from Cravath when. He should have disclosed, he, Bolby, should have disclosed that there had been recent non-compete payments. But he had no intense conversations this was being lumped together with another defendant. He did not have the conversations that she puts him in with the Cravath lawyer. It was just a general painting of a broad brush.
Let me point you to one thing that she said. This is essay 215 to 216.
Right.
It says, defendants Black signed non-competition agreement with SAPC. He received $2 million, essentially, not to compete with himself. Even though APC had only one small paper that intended to sell, and you know, Black knew he was not a threat of competing, he nonetheless signed the non-competition agreement, took the money, and did not ask any additional questions. Now, what's wrong with that as an application of the ostrich principle to the facts of the case?
First, I'm not here to argue for Mr. Black, but everything is wrong.
I'm sorry. What? What? You're not prepared to... What are you not arguing?
I'm not here to argue specifically for Mr. Black, but everything is wrong with that statement. She has it wrong from beginning to end.
Okay, what's wrong with it?
Well, first of all, this money, as you are aware, the principal witness in this trial for the government testified, was previously owed management fees, previously approved management fees.
Well, actually, that's a bit of an overstatement. The corporation was, right?
I'm sorry?
The corporation was, not the individual defendants. Ravelston, is that how it's pronounced?
Well, Ravelston was the partnership, the closely held company in Canada, which
right. accrued the...
And these were the people who ran and owned Ravelston.
Well, Radler, right, but management fees had never been paid to them personally before. They've been paid to the corporation. They've been paid not out of transactional fees or... out of a management fund. So they had never been paid in this manner before.
This was done purely and simply for the tax advantage they believed.
But
they
it was done in a very unorthodox way, which supports the deliberate indifference.
Unorthodox doesn't make it criminal.
Well, it supports the deliberate indifference instruction.
Management fees and the individual non-competes were themselves a very recent manner. These would only come into effect with the discovery that
The context also supports the instruction, because the non-competes were useless in context to take
it was
over $2 million for the purpose of as consideration for not competing against a company that's exiting the newspaper business doesn't make any sense.
Let me answer that question. Our client got $137,500. Uncontradicted expert testimony said that's reasonable for a non-compete, and it wasn't...
The jury's entitled to reject that.
It is entitled, but the fact of the matter is it was not with one small newspaper, which is what the government keeps harping on. This was with any affiliated entity, and there were literally dozens, if not hundreds, of newspapers that these people were prevented from competing with as a result of this post-termination non-compete. It's a totally different kind of agreement than the others on which the jury acquitted. This was one that's, and Bowlby himself was had, as I put it in the brief, was 1 foot out the door. He was retiring. He was getting an amount of money that seemed pretty reasonable by expert testimony, uncontradicted, $137,500. In fact, the district court found at sentencing that he wasn't aware that anyone was getting any more than him. He could very well have believed that for the four senior executives of Ravelston, who had a lot of experience, to get a total of about $500,000 for agreeing never to compete with any of these affiliated newspapers, and not just this one snowboarder newspaper, total mischaracterization. And the judge just got it wrong because...
You're mixing two things. You're mixing the Canadian tax scam, which I realize not anything for us to be concerned about, but you're mixing that with the... With a legitimate agreement not to commit. You're saying, well, Boltby could have thought that such a tiny amount of money was indeed to compensate him for agreeing not to compete.
That's separate from
knowing it's a management fee and, you know, wanting it to characterize as a non-competition covenant for... Right. So which is it? If he receives this check, what, for $15,000 or whatever?
I don't know. 15 was the second one.
Without knowing, you know, where it's from, what it is,
Right.
Isn't it odd that he doesn't ask, you know, what is this, who authorized it, and so on?
Had he asked, as other people had before, he would have been told, as there was evidence at trial,
that
it was.
The fact that you don't ask something can be evidence have some guilty knowledge.
But the evidence at trial, Judge Posner, was that he was asked, he did ask, and was told by Atkinson, oh, these are the 15,000 that you're talking about, this is non-compete payment for Foreman-Paxson transaction. And Atkinson told the special committee that he had been told by Radner the same thing. And these fellows all believed,
Well, that's their testimony, of course.
No, but there was evidence about this.
Well, there's evidence, yeah, but there's evidence but that juries can disbelieve, right?
Well, I wonder, when it comes to APC, what does the jury rely on when it disbelieves the principal witness for the government when he says, I thought this was our money. Now, what do they point to? What do they rely on realistically, rationally, when the principal witness says, this was innocent? And had Mr. Bowlby asked Radler, he would have been
said there was a lot of other evidence to contradict Radler, and jury didn't have to believe
there wasn't. There wasn't. There was only this one.
You're getting into the details of the facts. You were arguing the... Well, I think we'll have to move on and hear from Mr. Safer.
Okay.
So thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much. I would only just add by saying that there was the least amount of evidence against Mr. Bowlby, and the brief...
Your client?
Mr. Bowlby is our client. And the government's brief is such that you can't tell which evidence came in against whom, and the least amount of evidence came in against him. It's okay. Very hard to keep that straight from the government's brief.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Safer.
May it please the Court, my name is Ron Safer. I represent Mark Kipnis, who is general counsel to the company. I would like to answer a couple of the points that were just made. Initially, the point that, well, this may have been suspicious because these management fees were paid in a different way than anyone else. And Judge St. Eve relied upon that in denying Mr. Kipnis's motion. But there is no evidence that Mr. Kipnis knew how Ravelston was paid. He is not a member of Ravelston. He is not an employee of Ravelston. He has never received a dime from Ravelston. He stands in a very different position. He doesn't know what is usual and what is unusual. With regard to the non-competition payments not making any sense, I think it does. And here to Mr. Kipnis, and here is why. There are two critical conversations, because the evidence is insufficient that Mr. Kipnis knew the APC payments were money stolen by Hollinger. Two critical conversations. One, Radler to Kipnis. Radler spoke to Kipnis and asked him to draw up the APC non-compete agreements. The government concedes this on their brief at page 13. At the time Radler talked to Kipnis, Radler believed that this money, this $5.5 million, had already been approved. He wasn't pretending. He believed it had already been approved by the audit committee for payment to Ravelston and its executives. That, Judge Posner, distinguishes this from the hypothetical that you posed, in that there's no dispute here in Mr. Kipnis's mind that this money is owed to Ravelston and its executives. That's the only evidence in the record of Mr. Kipnis's knowledge, other than his statement to Mr. Rosenberg, the lawyer for the special committee, that is exactly what he believed the money was from, because he had been told that this was previously approved management fees. Judge St. Eve says, well, in addition to circumstances about which Mr. Kipnis has no knowledge, she says, well, the agreement itself is evidence and, in essence, makes your Honor's argument, Judge Sykes. But that is not so when you don't know about the surrounding circumstances. This is a tax device. It makes perfect sense. And the agreement is consistent with the knowledge that this money is a tax device. The money has been set aside. It is going to be paid. It belongs to Ravelston and its executives. Now, Mr. Radler says, we have a way to get this money in a tax-free way, and the agreement itself is entirely consistent with that goal.
What counts was your client convicted of?
Only of counts 1 and 6, the APC counts, Your Honor. That is all. And there is simply insufficient evidence of it. He was innocent, and there is no evidence, none, for the jury to conclude otherwise. The evidence that Judge St. Eve relied on, with all due respect to her, was evidence which she applied broadly to the defendants. Mr. Kipnis stands in a much different position.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Safer.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Siskel?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Edward Siskel, and I'm here on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start this morning by focusing first on the APC payments and the evidence, the abundant evidence in the record that these were a theft from International. The government introduced substantial evidence, which the district court relied on in affirming these convictions. There was the testimony of the controller of the company, Fred Creasy, who testified that this $5.5 million did not come from management fees, and he further testified that there was no credit against management fees that were due and owing for that $5.5 million. We also showed the flow of funds. We walked the jury through with exhibits exactly where the money came from. We showed the money coming in from the CNHI 2 transaction as sales proceeds and being deposited into that account. And then we showed through the KPMG work papers and accounting documents that the $5.5 million was drawn from the sales proceeds of that CNHI 2 transaction.
But the non-competes ran in favor of APC, not the newspapers?
The non-competes were between APC and these four individual executives, yes. And really, there were sort of two separate...
What about Mr. Greenberg's point? He said that the agreement ran to all sorts of APC affiliates involving hundreds of other newspapers.
The defendants pointed to language in the contract suggesting that this ran to other affiliates, but the testimony, the only testimony about what the people who either prepared these agreements in the case of Mr. Kipnis and the people who signed them in the case of Mr. Radler was that these only covered one small paper in Mammoth Lakes, California, and Mr. Kipnis told the special committee investigators that he thought the agreements were silly precisely because all they covered was a single paper and the executives were being paid a huge amount of money not to compete with this one paper that they had no intention of ever competing against if in the unlikely event that they left the company. And it's worth noting also that the money was paid to them immediately at the time of signing, not at some later date if and when they left the company. Mr. Radler testified that his understanding of the scope of this agreement was that it only covered the Mammoth Times paper. This one paper in Mammoth Lakes. So the jury certainly had abundant evidence from which to conclude that these agreements to the parties involved in them were only with this one small paper, and that the amount that they were being paid for it was so out of proportion to what this agreement covered that they were engaged in a fraud and knew they were engaged in a fraud. But there is additional evidence beyond just the face of the agreements. We pointed to the face of the agreements, the checks that showed where the money was coming from, and then a substantial amount of concealment evidence for each one of these defendants that showed their consciousness of guilt. We showed that with regard to all of the defendants, when it came to disclosing these payments, they mischaracterized them. They falsely characterized them as payments for that were part of a newspaper transaction when there was no newspaper transaction here. They also characterized them as something required by the buyers, or I mean, in this case, the only other side would have been their own company. And the evidence from everyone on the audit committee and on the board of directors was that there was no discussion of wanting, requiring non-competition agreements from these executives. It simply didn't happen because there was no discussion about it at all. These were agreements that the defendants decided amongst themselves to use to disguise their theft of $5.5 million from the company.
What is your conception of the honest services crime as applied to the facts here in light of Mr. Frye's argument?
Your Honor, the government presented the honest services fraud here as based on precisely the same conduct underlying the property fraud theory, that not only did these four defendants steal money from their company, but they were fiduciaries of that company who used their positions in the company, misused their positions in the company, where they were entrusted to negotiate these contracts on behalf of the company, to enter into contracts or to negotiate the sales of newspaper assets on behalf of the company and in its best interest, and misused that substantial authority and discretion.
So you're saying that the theft by a fiduciary equals an honest services fraud? Is that...
Well, what I'm saying is that when a fiduciary misuses their position to steal money for private gain, that is an honest services fraud. It is also a property fraud, but the government frequently charges alternative theories when the facts and the law support both.
I think Mr. Frye suggested that they weren't required to find a private gain.
No, the instructions very specifically said that the misuse of gain had to be for their private gain or the gain of a co-schemer. So the instructions made very clear, and I don't think anyone disputes that what was going on here and what was motivating these actions was for private gain of these four executives. And in the case of...
Maybe what he's worried about, I can ask him, but maybe what he's worried about is that if all they were trying to, if they really were management fees, suppose these, contrary, of course, to your position, a jury fine and so on, but suppose these really were management fees that they were recharacterizing in order to get a Canadian tax benefit for themselves. That would be private gain, but it wouldn't be private gain at the expense of their principal.
And,
right?
And Your Honor, we
so
have...
Would they be convicted for that?
Well, yes, and we have laid out in our briefs precisely why that is consistent with this Court's honest services precedent. I mean, what that would entail is that the defendants decided...
So in my hypothetical about stealing from the cash register, you're doing it for private gain, but you're not harming your principal. So you would say that's still...
Well, the one thing that I would add to the hypothetical, Your Honor, that I think makes it closer to what was going on here is if in the process of doing that, the attorney writes up a false contract to explain the $100 as being something other than what it actually is, has a representative of the law firm sign off on that agreement on behalf of the law firm. I mean, there I think, yes, what you have is a fiduciary using their position for private gain, but also doing it in such a way that is falsifying the records of the law firm, or in this case, the company.
Did you make that argument in support of the alternative theory here, that the conduct, even if legitimate under the as a tax device, left the company
exposed?
We
did not, in closing argument, lay out in that kind of detail that, you know, jury, even if you believe that this was management fees, here's why it's still an honest services fraud. We did explain what the honest services fraud theory was, that, you know, and pointed to instructions that misusing your position for private gain is honest services fraud. And the facts in our submission supported that theory based on the instructions. But no, Your Honor, we did not make that an explicit argument.
Did you describe for the jury what the fiduciary responsibilities were?
Yes, absolutely. We both the instructions set out what those fiduciary responsibilities were. They explained that the executives were required as fiduciaries to act in the best interest of the company and to not take actions that conflicted with the interests of the company. And arguably, you know, choosing because you want a tax benefit to doctor up a bunch of contracts that falsify the records and then eventually lead to false SEC filings is taking action in conflict with the interests of the company.
Those fiduciary instructions were based on expert testimony?
The instructions were based on Delaware law, and while there was certainly some dispute amongst the parties about how precisely to define the contours of that those fiduciary duties under Delaware law, by the time of the when the instructions were given, there was an agreement upon how those were defined, and certainly that is not an issue that's raised on appeal, that they did not correctly define what these executives owed to the company under Delaware law.
Was there any documentary support for this management fee explanation of these payments, or was it just Radler's testimony?
It was just Radler's testimony, and actually the documents in the record undermined that testimony. And what they showed was that not only the flow of funds that I've described, but that when the accounting was reviewed, it showed that this money was charged against sales proceeds, not against management fees. In addition,
and it was not discharging the debt owed to Ravelston.
There was
such a debt owed to Ravelston for management fees.
The documents did not show that, and we introduced internal pay records from Ravelston for that year. And what those showed is that these executives did not receive $5.5 million in bonuses. It just there's nowhere in there that this $5.5 million is tracked in the payments that went to these executives. These were side payments that they decided on their own to make and stole from sales proceeds that were owed to International. There was certainly abundant evidence from which the jury could reach that conclusion.
Follow up on an earlier question by Judge Sykes. Did you tell the jury that they could convict of an honest services fraud even if they found that the management fees were proper?
Your Honor, we did not explicitly make that argument. Our view was by the time of closing arguments, one of the defendants' counsel had even conceded the issue that these did not come from management fees. We had shown through abundant evidence why this was a theft of money that was due and owing International, not these defendants. And so we did not explicitly lay out why, even if the jury concluded that it wasn't management fees, here's why it's still an honest services fraud. That said, I do think that it is consistent with the law, and there were facts in the record that supported it, that the jury could have concluded that this was an honest services fraud, even if these weren't management fees. If these were management fees.
So the argument was in the nature of it's not either or, it's both? Property or money fraud and honest services fraud?
Oh, absolutely. And that, you know, we argued in closing And the entire way we presented the case was that this was both a property fraud and an honest services fraud, and that applied to all the various transactions. So it's not as if we tailored something for the APC payments, you know, because all of these were a theft by fiduciaries who were using their position in order to carry that out.
Right. No, I understand now. And if that was the posture or theory of the case, it's not either or, it's both, does that, as a legal matter, survive Orsborne?
I believe it does, Your Honor. There is nothing in Orsborne, in the holding of Orsborne, that says that the government...
That was a guidelines case, too. But
it was a guidelines case. It was, you know, in the context of how a charging decision would affect guideline calculation. But I think even so, there's nothing in the holding of that case that requires the government to elect one or the other when the same conduct violates a statute in two different ways. I mean, this is frequently the way that the government charges cases when you have facts that meet both aspects of how a statute can be violated in the context of 924C violations, even in bank robbery cases. The government charges these in the alternative when the very same conduct, based on the way the statute is defined, violates it in two different ways.
That is perhaps one way that case can be read, though, and perhaps requires clarification.
That may be necessary, Your Honor, but I think that it is clear that, that in many cases the government has charged honest services and property frauds based on the same conduct, and to the extent that Orsborne needs to be clarified to indicate that is still good practice, then I think you're right, it does. There are a couple of points that I would just like to clarify about some of defense arguments. With regard to the issue of the SEC, the instruction about the SEC filings, not only did the defendants not present an instruction that said you shouldn't base it solely on false SEC filings, but this came up earlier in front of the district court judge. The defendants made that objection, and the judge said, and this is, we cited in our brief, and it's at transcript page 3815, I think your proposed instruction is too broad. It's going too far because you're saying, and she referenced her earlier rulings, that this is relevant evidence that goes to the defendant's state of mind at the time that they engaged in these transactions. I would also like to clarify that each and every one of the passages from closing arguments that are cited in the defendant's reply brief to suggest that the government somehow said that the crime here was the SEC filings, they did not object to any of those comments. You can look at them after each one. There is no objection. But it was clear from the context of those statements that what the government was saying is we were responding to a persistent theme throughout the defense case that these payments were everywhere out in the open, and so how could there be a fraud? And we were simply pointing out that the crime here involved not just stealing the money, but that when they did describe them, they lied about what these payments were. If I could just briefly talk about the ostrich instruction. The opinion issued by the district court went through the evidence that supported that instruction. The district court judge was in the best position to view the evidence in light of the defenses that had been put on during the case. And it's a little bit lost in the briefs here, but a persistent theme of the defense in different ways for each defendant was essentially that they were duped, that they didn't know what Radler was up to. And in those circumstances, with a defense like that where there was substantial evidence that we pointed out and that the district court relied on to show that there were suspicious circumstances that would raise red flags and that each of these defendants cut off their normal curiosity, did not inquire further, and that this was not a case that was a binary choice between actual knowledge and innocence. The defense put on in different ways by each of the defendants was that they didn't connect the dots. And what the government pointed out and what the district court agreed with was that the evidence which came in based on those defenses supported the instruction. And the instruction that was given, which was the one requested by defendants, made very clear that there had to be evidence of deliberate indifference and that mere negligence was not enough. So if there was any concern about the instruction here, I think it was clearly harmless error, given that the instruction made clear precisely what mens rea was required, and it was used minimally during closing arguments, and that the evidence supported, substantial evidence supported actual knowledge on the part of these defendants.
Mr. Siskel, could you address the obstruction of justice issue with...
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. The government introduced substantial evidence to show that Mr. Black's conduct was intended to obstruct three official proceedings. The jury was instructed on what the required showing was to show corrupt intent. And there, to respond to a couple of points made by defense counsel, there was no evidence that the government had been through these documents before Mr. Black removed them.
What was pending at the time the documents were removed?
At the time the documents were removed, there was an SEC investigation pending, and just about 2 months earlier, Mr. Black's lawyers had been informed through a public filing that there was an ongoing criminal investigation here in the Northern District into precisely the charges that were, or a lot of the same allegations that were at issue in the SEC investigation, and that ultimately, through the criminal investigation, resulted in the charges in this case. And the evidence showed that in each one of the 13 boxes that Mr. Black removed from his offices that day, there were documents that were relevant to both the SEC investigation and to the government's criminal investigation. And the notion that, because these had been produced before, there couldn't be corrupt intent, the fact is that the evidence showed there was no way to tell from the production where documents had come from, and that it is significant to a criminal investigation. It's significant to any investigation where documents are found, whether someone possesses a document in his files. The evidence showed that while we do know what Mr. Black returned when he was required to do so 6 days later, that each of the boxes contained relevant documents, we simply do not know, and there is no way of knowing what was removed on May 20th. Because Mr. Black, there was no catalog done of those boxes before they were removed, and he had them in his sole possession for 6 days.
So it's an inference, the intent, sort of an inference, right?
Well, I mean, I think it is an inference from the circumstantial evidence of his corrupt intent, and that is absolutely permissible under the law for the jury to have relied on that. The point about not knowing what, in fact, was removed, I think, goes to the notion that this undermines an investigation. When you take documents, even if you can sort of point to what you returned and say, oh, they had all that stuff before, we simply do not know what was removed on May 20th. And we know that these came from Mr. Black's offices, and he is in the best position to know what's in those and that they contained documents that were relevant to ongoing criminal investigations and an SEC proceeding.
His assistant testified that the plan was that the documents were to be taken to her home for purposes of setting up a temporary office, and instead he took them to his home?
Yes, she initially testified that these were supposed to be removed to her home for a temporary office, and then that testimony fell apart because it became clear that Mr. Black took the boxes. Even though her car was nearby, they weren't put in her car to take to her office. There was no arrangement made to bring them to her house that day, the next day, or at any point until Mr. Black was ordered to return the boxes. So, the notion that this was just to set up a temporary office, that her testimony actually hurt the defense and showed that Mr. Black's conduct was inconsistent with that and consistent with trying to remove these documents, because he knew at the time he removed it, based on the fact that she was prevented from removing them, that if he waited the weekend, it was going to be a lot harder to remove documents from those offices. A protocol was being put in place that court-appointed inspectors would have to review documents before they could leave.
Could you just say a word about Kipnis in light of Mr. Safer's argument there's just no evidence at all against him?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The notion that Mr. Kipnis did not know about how management fees were paid to Ravelston is simply belied by the record. It was disclosed in the 10-Ks filed every year for the company that, the way that compensation was paid for these individuals is that management fees were paid to Ravelston. And, Mr. Kipnis is the general counsel of International, and I think the jury could certainly infer that he knows that the way that the senior executives who provide management fees to the company that he's general counsel of is that they get paid by Ravelston. They don't get paid by checks from an International subsidiary. In addition, Mr. Kipnis, when he was interviewed about these agreements, said that they were silly. The testimony from the special committee investigator was not that he had said Mr. Radler told him that these were management fees. The testimony was that he recalled Kipnis mentioning something about these being management fees, but did not recall him saying that it was Radler who told him that. And the jury could consider the fact that these statements made by Mr. Kipnis are being made in November or October of 2003, when there is a special committee investigation into these payments, and that it was a self-serving explanation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Siskel. So, defendants, counsel, your time has expired, but we'll give you a couple of minutes if you have anything of note. Mr. Fry?
I have about 6 or 7 points. I'll try to make them very succinctly. First of all, on the mammoth times and the sham non-compete and the way these things were paid, court has to ask itself, if this was a recharacterization motivated by Canadian tax purposes, was there anything suspicious or strange about these things? Of course the money was paid directly to the executives instead of through Ravelston, because that was the whole point of being able to the executives to get tax-free treatment in Canada. Now, that may have been a fraud on Canada, although the evidence was strong that it wasn't.
Well, they're not the sole shareholders of Ravelston, are they?
They control Ravelston, but Black could decide. Black clearly had the power. First of all, there's not a fraud on Ravelston. That's not the charge fraud. Secondly, Black clearly had the power to direct and Radler to direct where the money would go.
My point is that it goes to the unorthodox nature of this as a tax structuring device.
But it's not. I don't know whether you mean it's unorthodox from the standpoint of Canadian law. The question, I think we're agreed that the question here is, was this money that was owed by International anyway? Because the question is whether International money was misappropriated by these defendants.
Right, it was owed to Ravelston. It wasn't owed to these individuals.
But if it was owed and this satisfied that obligation and it was not otherwise paid, then there was no loss to International. There was no misappropriation of International's funds. How it was routed through Ravelston or around Ravelston doesn't change the fact that International did not suffer a loss of money or property. This was not a scheme.
I thought I heard, particularly Mr. Greenberg, kind of contradictions. Sometimes that these really were legitimate, you know, non-competition payments because of these hundreds of newspapers affiliated. And other times it's just a tax thing. So
I want to be clear about that.
Can't be true, so...
They could actually both be true. We are not saying that this was motivated to give a benefit to International. We are not saying that that was the case. We are saying when the government has its mammoth time story, that the fact is that the non-compete agreement did more than that. But we're not defending it. The question was whether it was going to be good enough to pass muster with Canadian tax authorities. The question for the court here is whether there was a misappropriation of International's money. If the money was owed by International,
But are the defendants clear that these are management fees and not actual non-competition compensation? Or
management
what?
Fees recharacterized for Canadian tax purposes as non-competition payments.
So the hundreds of affiliated newspapers of APC, that's not relevant.
It's not really relevant, except that it's a response to the government's argument that there was only one, that the agreement was a sham. It's not really relevant because whether it was a sham or not...
You're saying these were management fees that were recharacterized as non-competition compensation for Canadian tax purposes.
That's correct.
I don't know how they can be both a sham and a legitimate...
For Canadian tax purposes, it may matter. For purposes of I'm not sure why it doesn't matter whether it doesn't matter whether
they non-competition pay.
Doesn't matter whether we are not saying that International got $5.5 million worth of benefit out of this deal. If the $5.5 million had been money that International was otherwise entitled to, we're not saying there wouldn't be a fraudulent scheme here. Although there would still be a question about knowledge. Let me just make a couple of other points. I'm sure the court will look carefully at the government's representations because there are many things that they say that are not so. But just to take the Creasy testimony, for example, and I have to say that Judge St. Eve did cite some stuff, but of course it's your job to look at that stuff and see whether a reasonable jury could find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt based on that evidence. What Creasy actually said was that they were management fees that had not yet been paid, and that he didn't know whether they were ever paid. And the government knew from the time of the grand jury testimony or before that Rattler was saying these were management fees, and yet they made no effort at trial to prove that the management fees had otherwise been paid. This is a major gap in the government's case, and it's crucial to the money property theory. Now, on the... On the honest services point, our position is that you do need pecuniary loss in this category of case. That is, there has to be a money or property loss. Our position is that the government cannot simply say, well, stealing money from your employer is a breach of honest services. It's true in the lay sense or the colloquial sense of the language. It's not a violation of Section 1346 under Thompson and Orsburn. And let me say that while Orsburn was a case about sentencing, Thompson was not. And the court said in Thompson, the history of honest services prosecution is one in which the private gain comes from third parties who suborn the employees with side payments, often derived by a kickback scheme from public contracts. Treating Section 1346 as limited to such situations is consistent with its language, etc. So that's a pretty clear statement on that point. And what happened in this case was that the jury was allowed to convict without finding any harm to International. And that is the gravamen of our problem with the honest services thing. Now, if there's not enough evidence to show money or property loss, I think the case is over. If there is enough evidence, you still have to wrestle with the question whether the defendants were prejudiced by the submission of the honest services counts, which never should have been submitted in the first place, and which allowed conviction without finding any scheme to defraud international money or property. Just one or two other points on the obstruction. The fact that they were relevant documents in the boxes gets the government nowhere, in my opinion. Of course, these were Mr. Black's copies of ink documents, many of which bore on transactions that were the subject of these investigations.
I mean, it was bizarre. The timing was bizarre.
Well, what was bizarre about the timing?
The removal of the documents during the investigation. I don't understand that.
Excuse me, I'm not sure I understand what was bizarre about the timing. He was about to be evicted. The timing was set by his secretary, who decided that day that she would move the things. There's no evidence that he knew of any development in the case that would have prompted him.
She would move them where?
She would move. She was originally going to move them to her offices when she was not allowed to remove them. And by the way, there is no evidence that he knew about the inspector's protocol, that whole thing. They just simply don't have evidence that he knew anything about any of that. So this whole story that he, you know, needed to take them then because if he hadn't taken them then, he couldn't have taken them later, which is complete speculation.
When was the eviction date? The eviction date
May
was 31st. The end of the month. And how far in advance was this particular?
About 10 days in advance.
10 days in advance.
But the date was picked by the secretary. It wasn't, you know, there's no evidence, and it's not the case that Mr. Black said to the secretary, let's pack up the stuff and get it out of here. She was cleaning out her offices as part of the process.
That's her testimony, of course.
Well, there's no contrary testimony. The problem is the government has to prove its case. It's true you could disbelieve.
There's a lot of evidence, right? And you have your evidence both ways. A lot of your arguments are just, you know, they're closing arguments.
I don't think that's at all the case. Certainly not in the obstruction.
Okay. Do you have anything further?
No.
We've been going on for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
President.
Is there anything from any of the other?
Briefly. Your Honors, Mr. Siskel stated that the defense was that the defendants were duped, but that there was abundant evidence of actual knowledge that these payments were the product of fraud, and that is simply not so. Particularly with respect to Mr. Atkinson, there is simply insufficient evidence of his knowledge or intent from which a jury could convict. These payments, it's undisputed, were not Mr. Atkinson's decision to direct. These payments were directed by David Radler, and as such, Mr. Radler is the only witness who knew why these payments were directed, what they were intended to be. And even the government elicited from Mr. Radler, both in the grand jury and before the jury, that these payments were directed with the understanding that they were entitled to the money.
Well, the absence of a written record is pretty damaging.
The absence of a written record. I'm not entirely sure what Your Honor means when you say the absence of a written record. The record was that that the audit committee had approved earlier in the year a certain amount of management fees to be owed, and Mr. Radler testified that we were entitled to the money.
Well, and it was a credit on the books against the management fees fund.
That has to do with an accounting issue, an internal accounting issue.
Accounting issue. It's a big company. They have accountants. They keep books. They record large payments.
And the witness that testified on that point, Mr. Creasy, said he did not know anything about these payments. And he specifically said, with respect to whether these were whether management fees were otherwise paid, he did not testify that the management fees were otherwise paid, which should have been a relatively simple thing for the government to prove if it were so. Mr. Creasy's testimony was, I have no knowledge that it was paid, but I have no reason to doubt that it wasn't paid. He had no idea. There was no testimony that these management fees were otherwise satisfied or whether this $5.5 million was exactly as Mr. Radler testified, that it was the remaining management fees owed for the year, and that they were entitled to the money. But with respect to Mr. Atkinson,
okay,
I just want...
Thank you, Mr. Safer. We'll have to move on. Mr. Greenberg?
At the risk of sounding presumptuous, here's what I think should trouble you. The government gave Radler, their chief witness, a script to read in the grand jury in which he said, this was our money and we were going to recharacterize it for tax purposes. At trial, they elicited the same testimony. By the end of the trial, they were simply arguing Radler was mistaken. It wasn't. For the first time on this appeal, the government is now saying Radler was lying. They were all in it together. They're all lying. They're all crooks. They embraced Radler. They put him forward and adopted his testimony. The court should be offended to find that the government now, for the first time, claiming that their principal witness is lying when they never made that argument below, and they put him in the grand jury, and they allowed him to testify under oath at trial. Now, Judge Posner, you said it couldn't be both for purposes of taxes as well as non-compete. I simply don't understand how you couldn't get that. The fact of the matter is, these were legitimate non-compete agreements. Not the motive for why they were doing it to benefit the company, but they were non-compete agreements. And Mr. Fry said, well, maybe it wasn't worth $5.5
million. Well, you're going to argue.
But for my client, it was only $137,500.
Why don't you submit your own brief if you have disagree with your fellow?
It's not a problem. The fact of the matter is,
You said it was irrelevant.
It has market value. Experts testified that. For Jack Boulpe,
I don't understand. You're saying this is legitimate compensation for their promising not to compete. He's saying they're management fees.
They are management fees. That's what the government's evidence showed. Uncontradicted. They were management fees.
Easy.
And recharacterized simply for the purpose of taxes.
But you just said they're legitimate compensation for not competing. That's not a management fee.
Hold on a second.
You don't get a management fee for agreeing not to do something in the future.
This is a post-termination fee.
To be paid not to do something in the future is not a management fee. Right?
I understand. But the fact of the matter is, the non-compete agreements were real, had value, and they also were characterized this way for purposes of taxes. I don't see what the conflict is. They have value as non-competes. They have an economic substance as non-competes. And the money that came was their own money, according to the government's own witness. Finally, just one word. You heard the reference by the government to one of the defendants saying everything was silly. That's an example of something that didn't come in against my client. Just one perfect example of why you have to read the government's brief very carefully. Because all these post-scheme statements did not come in against anybody but the people that made them. Thank you.
So, Mr. Schachter, do you have anything further also?
Safer, Your Honor. I'm Mr. Safer on behalf of Mr. Kipnis. Not at all. Three brief points. One, regarding Mr. Siskel's comment that Mr. Kipnis knew about Ravelston management fees. Of course he did. He knew that they were approved every year. He did not know, and there is no evidence to show, how they were paid. This was a very closely held company. The record is replete that these four executives were Ravelston. There is nothing out of the ordinary. And in terms of documentary evidence, that there was no documentary evidence, this audit committee approved $218 million of management fees without a piece of paper, without being shown a single record. It was not your typical company. Second, the silly comment, and Mr. Siskel says, first of all, that Mr. Kipnis did not say that he understood to the special committee that he understood that this was a way of recharacterizing management fees. That is flat out wrong. Page 9437, he says it on direct. Now, it is true he doesn't remember who told him, and that is on page 9624. You testified that Mark said his understanding was that the APC non-compete payment was a way to recharacterize the management fees. Yes. He was told that by David Radler. He said he was told by somebody. I don't remember whether it was David Radler. But he testified that that was his understanding, and Mr. Siskel is just flat out wrong about that. He said they were silly. On Mr. Rosenberg said what Mr. Kipnis ultimately said. He said, I don't remember what he thought was silly about it, whether it was Mr. Radler's obsession with tax-free money or whether it was this one company deal. But silly is not unlawful. An executive can think that the direction that executives are taking the company is silly in many ways without it being unlawful.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So we'll move on to our next case. Pardon?
Mr. Black's motion for bail pending appeal, RLEPR.
Excuse me? Say that again?
To renew Mr. Black's motion for bail pending appeal for your consideration.
Okay. Fine. Thank you. So our next case for argument is...